Winnow, a podcast about dining in the South and beyond. I'm Robert Moss, the author of Barbecue, the History of an American Institution.
And I'm Hannah Raskin, food editor at the Post and Courier.
Today, it's the big cheese edition of the Winnow because we're going to talk about a bunch of different cheesy topics. A couple of episodes ago, we talked about Mexican food and the Speedy Gonzales and it sort of got a little bit into queso and in the world of cheese. And that, I think, continued us further down this path. So we are going to head down to Mexico again and look at some cheese there. But first, I think we'll look more toward Italy, and in particular, what you might call a relatively new form of Italian cheese, which is burrata cheese. And Hannah, I know you wrote a piece recently about burrata and the history of burrata.
Right. I am not entirely clear on the history of burrata, but what I can tell you about is that people have gone crazy for it.
I did look up a little bit of the history, just enough to know it's not that old. It doesn't go back years and years and years, but it goes back to, you know, back into the 20th century in various parts of Italy.
Right. It does seem, I don't know if it's just the way it's framed, but it does seem like a luxury item. Like I can't imagine you'd be making this if it was all the cheese you had left. I don't think you would want it just to ooze around.
Yeah. And if you haven't had burrata, the first time I had it, it was sort of weird because I've been eating fresh mozzarella, which I love. Particularly, there's a restaurant called Bacco in Mount Pleasant that makes their own sort of hand-pulled mozzarella, which is absolutely delicious. And so that had been around for a while. I've sort of fallen in love with that. And then when I was at Mercado, the waiter said, well, it's sort of like mozzarella, but creamy in the middle. And I was like, okay. And then it struck me as just very, very strange because it's like a big ball of mozzarella. You slice into it, and inside it's sort of like biting into a cream donut or something. There's like this orb of cream inside that runs out all over the place. And at first, I thought it was really weird. Now I've fallen in love with it. I think it's really tasty.
Right. Well, so not just you. So the way
I'm not alone.
The reason I started writing about this is I was reading a preview copy of Matt and Ted Lee's new book about catering and specifically the catering industry in New York. And I believe we've had Matt on the show before.
Yeah, sure have.
So this is their first book that's not a cookbook. This is just straight up narrative nonfiction. And because of that, I think although you know, they're obviously fantastic writers and they do lots of newspaper and magazine writing, I think they still have a bit of that cookbook leaning so that it is a narrative nonfiction book with like nice drawings. And between some of the chapters, you get these lists of statistics, kind of like the old Harper's Index sort of thing. And I was going down one of them. So it's just, you know, how many aprons did a guy wear one night or how many knives did they give out? And then one of the statistics, and again, this is just like a tiny, teeny, tiny line.
Stuck in the middle of the
right, which is said that in 2016, one of the primary upscale catering companies in New York, in 2016, they sold 325 balls of burrata. Okay? So that's like one party, maybe two. In 2018, 2 years later, they sold 12,300 balls of burrata.
Now, my math's not so good, but that's a rather large increase.
So that's amazing. So I was like, that is an enormous, literally overnight increase, just all of a sudden. And as you say, it totally tracked with what I've been noticing, which is, for instance, here in Charleston for Restaurant Week in January, Restaurant Week menus tend to be very much the same. You know, it always ends with creme brulee and typically starts with a soup that really you should not be paying money for. But now there's a burrata almost on every menu.
Oh, I didn't know that. So now it's like
it is the creme brulee of the appetizer section. And in really, that's actually true because what burrata functions is basically just like butter. Like it's just mild tasting fat. So you can put it with anything, which is, I think, what chefs really like about it. And what customers really like about it. It's really hard to say I don't like burrata because it just tastes like goodness.
It's true, though. You don't just serve a ball of burrata by itself and carve into it. You got to have something with
it. No, I mean, you could serve it with, like, if you had a very special sort of bread or cracker to accompany it. But, yeah, you're not just – I mean, this is not – you're not going to grab, like, an apple and just bite into it. Like, it definitely needs supporting players, no question. But – so it's – and it's not just restaurants. So – I don't know if catering led the charge on this or if restaurants did. I'm not certain. Catering tends to be behind restaurants, but in this case, it may have been a little ahead because, again, pleasing the crowd is such a catering obsession.
That seems like a catering thing, too, because you can put it out with like your fancy dishes and your little carvers and all the little things that go with it.
Right. And it performs without being really taken care of. You don't need to keep it under a heat lamp. You probably don't want to. You know, you don't want to keep it on ice. I mean, it's just, you know, you'll keep it cool for as long as it needs to be. But then you want it to warm up so it gets super seductive, you know. So it's probably a pretty good item for a party. So I checked in with the folks at Duval, which is one of our leading catering companies here in Charleston. And they were unaware of the burrata trend until they checked their records. And I said, oh, my goodness. I said, we're going to be serving a lot of burrata this year. So I had talked to them maybe, let's say it was like a week into January, something like that. And at that point, they had served burrata at 6 parties. This was like January 10th. They had served hundreds and hundreds of bottles of burrata. When last year, they've already served more than they did last year. That's the point. In 10 days,
they served more
burrata than they served in all of 2018.
So others assumed it was like a 2018 thing. But it's
still going up. So this is why when I wrote the story, I headlined it like, if you're going to a party, you will eat burrata. Wow. I mean, you can be sure of it in Charleston. This year, entertaining is all about burrata.
I'll say it. At my house, we eat burrata a lot. I often will get it when I have guests over because you can find it in grocery stores now. And I swear.
I didn't realize.
Yeah, 2 years ago, you couldn't.
Oh, that's really interesting. But it's in like the gourmet section,
if
right?
You go to your cheese counter. Yeah. But, you know, where they have like the tubs of mozzarella,
where
fresh
they keep
mozzarella.
The real Parmesan.
Yeah, where they have the real Parmesan wheel and they have like the good cheddar and all that.
Yeah.
And then they'll have the tubs of fresh mozzarella in water.
Yep.
And these days there's often burrata right there sitting next to it. And
wow.
Usually it's like 2 balls of burrata in a little tub. And you can get it. And, you know, I always just do something like tomatoes tossed with a balsamic vinaigrette, tear up some basil, mix them together and just serve it over that. And it's super, super simple.
Yeah.
Everybody loves it.
And everyone loves
it's
it.
It's so creamy and
but,
just
okay,
sort of rich.
So just before I was coming into the office to write about burrata cheese, I ran into John David Harmon, who briefly had JD Loves Cheese at the workshop, which is the food court here. He was selling grilled cheese and other cheeses. So the point is, John David loves cheese.
He's a cheese guy.
He's a cheese guy.
He has a
background in cheese retail. And he says, what's really interesting, he thinks that burrata became this popular because people like to say the word burrata.
Hmm.
And because essentially burrata is not that, I mean, the example he gave was that Gruyere outsells Comté, even though they're the same cheese. Because people like to say
Gruyere.
Either
they like it or they can't say it. I guess because they like it. It sounds Gruyere. It does sound fun to say.
You're looking for those vowels. Yeah. So Gruyere is like burrata. So that's, I mean, he thinks that's a big part of it. The other examples he gave were chorizo, sancerre. Mm-hmm. These are things he thinks that part of their popularity is can be credited to what the word sounds like.
Hmm. That's an interesting theory.
Yeah. I have no idea if it's true, but I like it.
It is a fun thing to say.
It's a fun thing to say, burrata, and you'll be saying it a lot more.
Another reason I think people like it, though, is just because Americans love soft, white, creamy things.
Yep.
And this is like mozzarella, but then with that even softer, creamier middle in the middle of it. So I think it's like mozzarella. You know, it goes up to 11.
Right. And we know Americans like mozzarella.
Yes, because it's super creamy. Not a big fan of the stinky raw milk cheeses and all that.
Right.
And this is the exact complete polar opposite. It's so mild.
Right.
It's almost like milk, you know, just drinking cream.
Right,
you know?
right. It's a cheese pizza for grown-up.
I was thinking about this while we're on the topic of burrata, and you say, oh, the creme brulee of the Restaurant Week advertiser. How are chefs serving it around here? Because I always just do it with the tomatoes and tomato basil, a little vinaigrette. Are you seeing any creative ways that, or is it all just pretty much the same?
I mean, I looked at a couple of these Restaurant Week menus. So at Indaco, they had it with chili and sweet potatoes, which is
sweet potatoes I would not have picked.
I wouldn't have picked the chili necessarily, even though, you know, obviously dairy has a calming effect on any sort of spice, but I thought that was kind of interesting. McCready's Tavern put Green Goddess dressing on it. And at Aldi La, they did it like a caprese salad. I saw that a lot.
Yeah, that's
caprese.
The common.
Just put
that's
some tomatoes. Right,
you should basically use it like you would fresh mozzarella, but with, you know, with creaminess.
And then at the opposite end of the spectrum of the savory chili and sweet potatoes at the Barbados Room at Mill House, they did a pomegranate and candied walnuts.
Oh, that sounds good. I was just thinking about that because I tend to go on the savory, but you can certainly go sweet with that because it's so creamy.
Like anything that you think of as a cheesecake preparation, you could definitely sub it right in.
Oh, back to our Mexican restaurant. could you do a deep fried burrata?
Oh, like deep fried ice cream.
Yeah.
I don't know. Would it hold its...
Well, if you could do ice cream, why couldn't you do cheese?
Yeah, if you can do ice cream, I think you could.
You just flash fry it. You're just getting the crust on it.
People would love it.
All right. Watch for it. I predict we'll see that soon. On the topic of cheese, you know, following up, we had talked a little bit about various types of cheese when we were talking about Speedy Gonzales and Mexican restaurants. And Emory had sort of brought up queso and the difference between Texas-style queso and Southern queso and all that. I don't have a lot of answers. I've been digging into it a little bit, but I did find a few fun facts about Mexican cheeses, the white cheeses that we see. And then, Hannah, I know that you recently took a trip down south to Mexico and to Oaxaca.
Yep.
And spent a lot of time with corn, which we may talk about in a different episode,
yep.
but also encountered the cheeses there. I guess I'll lead into it because the interesting thing that I found was looking into trying to figure out what is that white cheese that's omnipresent at Southern Mexican restaurants. And there's different types, but queso chihuahua is one of them,
right.
Which is a very common, just very mild white cheese. But it's also often called Menonita.
Oh, okay.
Which I did not know. And it actually after the Mennonite communities.
Oh, interesting.
In northern Mexico, yeah. Which I didn't even hadn't really read about or heard about before. But, you know, it's not a secret. But I just hadn't know about it. But is actually a considerable Mennonite population in the northern parts of Mexico. A lot of it came in the early 20th, moved there in the early 20th century from Canada.
Oh, interesting.
And, you know, coming originally from sort of German and Prussian ancestry and ended up in the Canadian provinces. And then during World War I, when there was a big backlash against German speaking and all that, a lot of Mennonites moved to northern Mexico and set up I guess you might call it a colony or set up, you know, living there, but very similar to Mennonites in, you know, sort of Pennsylvania in those areas, had their own community, traditional garb, and started making this cheese, which became well-known in the area and then eventually became industrialized as queso chihuahua.
Right.
Now, I haven't gotten too much further into that, but it just shows that these things are complicated. It's not as simple as you ever think. There's always more patterns and everything else.
And so, is that the same as the asadero cheese?
I think they're all variations. So it's a little bit different than an asadero, but related.
Because my understanding was that often the cheese from Oaxaca is confused with the cheese from Chihuahua, which was identified to me as asadero.
Yep.
So
I think there's still a couple of different ones from Chihuahua. So the Mennonita
cheese
is one of them. But I've only dipped my toe into it. I haven't got enough to know all the differences. That's also an interesting fact that there is German roots to all that somehow.
Right.
Via Canada, by way of Mexico, ending up on the menus here in the South.
Yep.
So now what you were down in Mexico, what were you doing down there?
I was looking at corn. that's all I did for a couple of days straight. You know, we can talk about this on another episode, but I was on a trip led by Glenn Roberts of Anson Mills, along with three sets of business partners, all of whom have some interest in reviving the heirloom corns originally of Mexico and then later of the Southeast United States. So that was all I was supposed to do was look at corn and eat corn. I ate so much corn that when my flight landed back in Atlanta, I went straight for the new Carrabba's there so I could eat
something that had
wasn't
no corn.
All I wanted was wheat flour.
An Italian restaurant. For
right. So, yeah, I wouldn't trust a polenta Carrabba's. Yep. So, no, I went straight for spaghetti. Anyways, the corn was amazing. But the one thing that we got other than corn, pretty much the only thing other than corn, if you don't count like cacao and so on, is cheese. And I had not, I think in the back of my mind, perhaps I'd heard of quesillo before, but I wasn't entirely prepared for it. So it is the signature cheese of the region, which just like you said, there was, you know, a wave of European immigration and they brought their dairy cows who apparently thrived on the mountainous, you know, hills of Oaxaca.
Is it sort of like Texas, you know, similar landscapes or?
Do they have any dairy cows in
Texas?
Well,
I guess it's more beef
That's
cattle.
That's beef cattle.
But cows certainly thrive in those areas.
Gosh. Yeah, it doesn't look like Wisconsin.
Right.
I'll say
beef.
That about Oaxaca.
It's
I am not a cow scientist, so I don't know how it came to be that the cows like being there, or maybe they've just adapted over hundreds of years. I don't know, but They are known for making this. It's essentially, it's a string cheese, really. I mean, it's just very, like, you pull it and it is snow white and it's super salty and it is delicious. I mean, it is like, it was certainly the I would say one of the culinary highlights of the trip was being on a farm where they were, you know, they'd handmade their own quesillo, which they had, as well as they were making their own blue corn tortillas. And then they had their own little salsa. And he put those things together.
I'm hungry now.
It's really pretty good. Amazing.
Is that cheese used primarily just sort of eaten by itself? It's not really used in recipes or things like that.
You know, as you know, there's lots of high-end restaurants both in Oaxaca, yep. Mexico City, and throughout the country. And so, I mean, they're playing with it as an ingredient. But when I was in just like family settings, which we were in a number of times, because we were going from farm to farm. It seemed to be just served as an accompaniment. Like, I think they even put it on the breakfast table. You know, you're having tamales, which, boy, this I had not had before. And this was, and I can't remember the word they use either there or typically in Spanish, but you put over this sort of like melted pork fat with cracklings in it. You pour that over your tamale. Oh my gosh, it is so good. I think they just had like kind of cheese out on the table, just the way you would put jam on the tree. It's just sort of there.
A condiment,
right.
Almost.
It's just like
a
condiment.
You put on there.
Right.
Which is interesting because as we were talking about queso, which mm-hmm. is now universally known as queso, of course, it was originally chili con queso, mm-hmm. and so which is chili with cheese. And I think that's sort of tied into it because I was going back and looking up old, trying to find chili con queso from way back. It goes way back into the 19th century as a Mexican dish. But it's basically stewed chili. So you would start with your peppers. You'd stew them. Sometimes do like a little flour roux kind of thing in it, make it real thick. And then sprinkle in cheese later as sort of an accompaniment. And, of course, that moved to Texas. And the cheese got more and more and more. And then we Velveeta and such things came on the scene. And soon it's now queso con chili would be a more accurate term. But I can see that that's, I think, where a lot of that started out was you had that white sort of sprinkle cheese that you'd sprinkle over the top or crumble over the top.
Mm-hmm.
It would be really delicious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great.
That's one thing I haven't seen a whole lot of in our stores. We have burrata's now showing up. You know, our cheese counters are certainly a lot more diverse than they were, 20 years ago when you may have had cheddar, American cheese, American cheese food,
right?
And such things. I do say cotija, cheese now a lot, which mm-hmm. is sort of the crumbly white cheese. So that's showing up these days. But I'd love to see some more of these. Like you get the fancy French imported cheeses and all that. I'd love to see some of those cheeses imported from places like Mexico.
I don't know how much of it is being done on a mass production scale. I don't know what is available. I mean, for instance, Mexico has this amazing wine industry, so we were able to drink Mexican wine throughout. You can't find it here, partly because there just isn't enough. They're not producing that kind of quantity. So that's part of it. Part of it, too, I think, is that some of these traditional cheeses are fresh cheeses. And we know there is an issue anytime there's a lack of pasteurization. America doesn't really want it. So there are, various rules. But who doesn't want to eat Mexican cheese?
I'm curious. There was a queso controversy.
Oh.
Now, is this person being tongue-in-cheek with this picture?
this is former White House Press Secretary Dana Perino.
Oh, that's who that is.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yep. So Embry is showing us a photo here on the iPhone of, I've never seen queso that color, which it looks brown. It looks almost like enchilada sauce. I can only assume this has made the rounds on social media.
Oh, yeah.
And what has been I can imagine what the negative reaction is, which looks like sewer sledge. Has there been defenders of this form of queso?
Chili's, actually.
The baby back ribs?
Yeah.
Place.
Oh.
Allegedly, she was trying to copy their recipe.
Ah. If we can switch topics for just a moment about copying recipes, I had an interesting discussion recently with Robert Dixon, who he's not been on the show, but we've spoken about him on the show because you went to an event.
Yes,
Roberts of
Charleston.
Exactly.
Which is the location, at least, is now the Gin Joint.
Right. So he was the restaurateur who was known for both cooking and mostly for singing.
Yes,
so,
he was a trained opera singer and would regale diners with these wonderful arias.
Yep. And so I had an opportunity to call up Robert because a reader asked, where can I get his seasoning mix? So there used to be a Robert's special seasoning mix.
It's like a season, like sort of Emeril's.
That's right. Yeah, it sounds like it's like a cure-all for everything you got. You know,
just put
a
little,
right. It's like his old bay or whatever, you know. So he had the spice mix, which he was, and I came to Charleston after Robert, so I never got to experience this. But apparently, the spice mix was beloved. This is really interesting. The spice mix had become so popular that he contracted with a co-packer at some point. So rather than just pounding it out in the kitchen, it was being made in such a way that he could also sell it in the restaurant, which makes sense because it seems like everyone loved it. So he was, you know, he got into the spice mix business. And then when he closed the restaurant, he decided to stop producing the spice mix because he thought, without the restaurant, how am I going to sell it?
Where's the marketing funnel?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could stick it online, but how are you going to promote it? You know, so he stopped making it. But people were just, they were just so sad because they really wanted the spice mix.
So did you get the recipe?
Well, let me tell you what happened. So he went into the kitchen and he pounded out the spice mix again. And they said, Robert, this isn't any good. They wanted the mass-produced stuff.
Ah.
And he couldn't reproduce it himself because he couldn't buy the same spices that if you're a wholesaler that you get in quantity. Yeah. It can't be done. And so there is no recipe.
There is no recipe for the ones that people love.
No. So it was
his was just too fragrant and flavorful or something because it was fresh crushed spices.
Who knows when he went into it, but only a factory could make it. Mm. And so he just gave up. So it reminded me of copycatting because that's the only way to achieve a flavor similar to.
Well, there is a whole series of books and websites devoted to recipes for how to make your favorite chain restaurant foods at home.
Yep.
Which leads us back, I think, to the Chili's queso.
Right.
Is that what Chili's queso looks like? Or is that more of a failed attempt?
No. Okay. Chili's tweeted out at her. They said, you know what, Dana? You were brave enough to put yourself out there, and we can respect that.
That's great.
That is a good one. Queso has generated lots of heat because there's a lot of dispute over whether, like, especially among Texans, you should use Velveeta or not in your chili con queso. Rob Walsh, the Texas food writer, has come to the defense of Velveeta, basically saying, you know, that's sort of what make queso what it is. It's not, you know, don't make it with expensive imported cheddar.
Right.
You're trying to take it uptown. There's some speculation because Lady Bird Johnson had a queso recipe that right after she became first lady, they moved into the White House. It was published in the Washington Post, published a recipe, but it was made with aged cheddar. And there's been lots of speculation that her real recipe, which was published later in her various cookbooks and used processed cheese, that somebody at the Washington Post had sort of gussied it up a little bit because they didn't want to run like an American, you know, processed American cheese recipe and the pages of the
fancy
Post,
people at the Post.
Yeah. So yeah, I sort of feel that way. I mean, it's certainly if you're, I would love to have true chili con queso. I don't think I've ever had like stewed chilies with like really good cheese. I'm sure that'd be great. But if you're going to go for that melty bowl, you might as well go all the way. You know, make it the white processed cheese and you know, just a little chilies, you know, thrown in there. I'm all for that.
And that is all for this edition of The Winnow. We recorded today's episode in the Mild Podcasting Studios at the Post and Courier Building in downtown Charleston, South Carolina. If you enjoy listening to The Winnow, help other listeners find us too. Just go to iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you access your podcasts and like us or leave a rating. The Winnow is a production of the Post and Courier and the Palmetto New Media. Our producer today was the lactose tolerant J. Maria Parker.
Oh, yeah.
Our theme music is by the Bluestone Ramblers.
Until next time, I'm Robert Moss.
And I'm Hannah Raskin.
Now get out there and eat.